They were, however, joining a parade of activity that I think constitutes the main point in a subtle but increasing redefinition of the world economy to match the new qualities of the contemporary period in world history generally. The contemporary period continues elements inherited from the long 19th, no question about it, but increasingly it puts its own stamp on these patterns. And really what one is probably dealing with by the later 20th, early 21st century was what some economists are calling really, for the first time, the industrialization of the world. By the late 20th century, after all the industrialization efforts that we've discussed previously in the West, the United States, Japan, even South Korea, by the late 20th century, probably about 20% of the world's population had been directly industrialized. But by the early 21st century, with the advance of industrial operations in Brazil, China, India, and elsewhere, probably upwards of 60%, another 40 in other words, were now actively involved in industrializing economies and industrial operations. This still left a really significant minority not yet touched, some of which was outright peripheral, but the change is huge. And this had one final implication, although one needs to be cautious here. The emphasis that the world economy had generated on the increasing inequality of economic relationships among different parts of the world, that's not gone. But increasingly by the 21st century, the key issues were actually not so much among regions but within them. Because what this process of partial industrialization or import substitution, what this process seemed to generate involved increasing wealth inequalities within countries, within China, within Latin America, within the United States. And these regional internal economic inequalities probably now increasingly commanded the greater attention now that the world economy was becoming so much more complex.
Lecture 31, An Age of Revolutions.
The 20th century was an age of revolution. Revolutions began in the second decade of the century and continued at least until the 1980s. Our discussion today focuses on the revolutions themselves in terms of their basic dynamics, the way they reflect fundamental changes in the contemporary period in world history, but of course, above all, the ways in which they actually help launch these changes, particularly in the societies directly affected, but to some degree more widely. At risk of a little tedium, we need to do a bit by way of definition. A revolution is a violent attempt to change the political system, introduce new personnel into that system, not just new people, but new social layers of people, and usually to effect some degree of social change. Revolutions obviously differ from coup d'etat. There are lots of coup d'etat in the 20th century and before. These can be significant in an individual society. They put a different person at the helm. They can be bloody to a certain degree, but they don't change the fundamental shape of things. There are a couple of instances at various periods in world history where one can also talk about revolutions from above. For example, Turkey in the 1920s under the great leader Kemal Atatürk can be seen as an effort to change society and aspects of political behavior in fundamental ways, but from state control rather than from upheaval from below. This is an interesting effort. It can be regarded as legitimately revolutionary, but it's not, in a literal sense, a revolution. The most important distinction, really significant for the 20th century, not uninteresting for earlier periods also, involves making some differentiation between revolutions and wars of independence. There were lots of independent struggles in the 20th century, particularly after World War II. They too were significant. When successful, as they usually were, they would obviously change the regime. They'd get rid of the imperial power. They would, by definition, change personnel. They'd get rid of the imperial power, and they could do some of the work of revolution in beginning a process of social reform, usually top-down, and even introducing changes more widely. But most wars of independence are not revolutions in the sense of using violence to undertake a kind of thorough political and social cleansing. The distinction is significant, even though the 20th century must be seen as a period of both types of phenomena. The 20th century, as a century of revolution, involves activities in many different parts of the world. It compares interestingly with the previous age of revolution, 1770s to 1848, which was an Atlantic zone. Very significant, we talked about it before, but involving Western Europe, the United States, Latin America, and leaving really most of the rest of the world out pretty much altogether. Revolutions in the 20th century didn't happen everywhere, and we'll need to come back to that point. But they did occur in parts of Eastern Europe, in significant parts of Asia, in significant parts of Latin America, in a few parts of the Middle East. This geographical spread represents a measurement of the extent to which activities that previously were regional now tend to become global. News of revolutions, news of the success of revolutionary regimes, inspiration from revolutionary leaders, these now could spill into societies that were very different in terms of cultural and political tradition from the societies where the revolutions occurred in the first place. There were four granddaddy revolutions in the 20th century. Three of them occurred in the second decade of the century, one in 1979. Revolution first broke out in Mexico in 1910-1920. It reflected a variety of grievances. It involved a variety of groups. There were important middle-class liberals involved in the revolution, seeking mainly to concentrate on political and constitutional reforms after a period of authoritarian dictatorship under Porfirio Diaz. There were peasant revolutionaries, Pancho Villa, others, interested in raiding, interested in many cases, fundamental land reforms. There were movements among urban workers. Mexico had, by this point, a significant, if minority, industrial sector. The goals of the revolution were quite varied, and not surprisingly, it took a decade of recurrent revolutionary activity for anything like a settlement to be worked out. The revolution ultimately produced a limited series of land reforms affecting some regions, but not the bulk of the country, and the installation of a one-party political system that provided political coherence, genuine but non-competitive elections, and other results that we'll come back to in trying to do more by way of summarizing revolutionary consequences more generally. The Mexican Revolution, in one sense, was somewhat unusual in having relatively little direct spillover. This was not a revolutionary contagion. But the example of peasant revolutionaries, the example of limited land reform and really moving peasant claims for access to land, this undoubtedly had an influence in other parts of Latin America where peasant risings would occur some decades later. The second great revolution of the second decade of the 20th century was the Chinese, truly historic. Beginning in 1911, a batch initially of middle-class revolutionary students, intellectuals, overthrew the imperial system, as far as we know, forever. A system that had recurred in China, and because it had recurred, one is slightly hesitant to say forever, but a system that had recurred in China for many centuries was now toppled, and an initial effort attempted to establish a Western-style parliamentary democracy, hampered tremendously by the power claims of regional warlords and landlords, hampered certainly subsequently by the invasion of the Japanese and by key divisions among Chinese revolutionaries between the nationalists who were heirs to the parliamentary liberal tradition, although increasingly authoritarian in style, and the new communist movement that was born in the early 1920s and would ultimately prevail. Essentially, the Chinese Revolution, up and down, interrupted by Japanese invasion, the Chinese Revolution would run from about 1911 until final communist victory in 1949. The third great revolution, initially the sort of bellwether of 20th century revolution, was the Soviet of 1917. There had been a foreshadowing in the Russian Rising of 1905. The communist revolution was certainly inspired by Russia's hardships in World War I, but it also fed from much longer-standing peasant and worker grievances, from the widespread concern about the police and authoritarian measures of the Tsarist regime, which, despite a modest concession right after 1905, continued to repress political expression. A variety of resentments boiled over. There was a brief period of liberal rule, complicated by a liberal effort to stay in the ranks of the World War I powers. But finally, during 1917 itself, the Bolsheviks took over and launched a period of significant political, social, and cultural upheaval. The final great revolution is really much different, and much later. The Iranian Revolution of 1979 was hailed at the time as possibly the first great, quote, third world revolution, a revolution not dependent on Western ideas of any sort. Remember, Marxism as well as liberal democracy were Western in origin. The Iranian Revolution was an Islamic revolution in a predominantly Shiite country, a rebellion against undue Western influence, against an authoritarian and in some ways corrupt political regime. It urged a return to more fundamental Islamic political principles. It represented a statement by peasants and others that the country had moved off its proper moorings. The revolution was meant to inspire, or was held possible, capable of inspiring, a wave of similar revolutions in other societies. In a literal sense, this obviously has not yet occurred, but perhaps judgment should still be out. In addition to these granddaddy revolutions, the 20th century, particularly after World War II, was peppered by other revolutionary surges in smaller areas. The 1950s, for example, saw a revolution in Egypt, Bolivia, and of course Cuba. The 1970s saw a revolution in Nicaragua. Vietnam constituted a revolution as well as a war for independence, an interesting combination, but the revolutionary component was quite significant. The number of episodes that ought to be regarded as revolutions certainly is open to subjective judgment, but we're dealing with a significant number overall in a significant number of places. One other point, partially definitional, deserves some emphasis as well. We know from our knowledge of earlier revolutions, like the Great French Revolution of 1789, and now we know from, for example, the Soviet experience as well, big revolutions, major upheavals, take a long time to work out. The actual revolutionary years may be 5 or 10. 10 in the Mexican case, 5 or so in the Russian case, 6 maybe from the 1917 rising to the end of the civil wars in 1922-23. The episode may be fairly short, but it really takes a long time for revolutionaries to work out their goals, for different sectors of society to react, to adjust, to internalize, for initial revolutionary excesses or experiments to be whittled down into more manageable proportions. For example, clearly, the French Revolution was not fully worked out in France until at least the 1870s, a literal century after the initial rising. And some would argue it took even longer than that for groups finally to reconcile themselves to a central revolutionary legacy. So the revolutions of the 20th century, in some cases, are still working themselves out. I'm convinced that later history will look back on the upheavals in the Soviet Union in the 1980s and early 90s as effectively part of the larger revolutionary trajectory. And obviously, the further workings of other revolutions need time as well. Revolutions, of course, never change everything. Revolutionaries in the 20th century sometimes argued they would, but revolutions always managed to preserve, unwittingly at least, significant segments of the, quote, old regime. The Russian Revolution, for example, tossed up institutions that looked quite similar to the Tsarist political police. The names changed, but some of the purposes and methods remained distressingly consistent. The Soviets also replicated some czarist interest in territorial expansion, though under new rhetoric, replicated czarist interest in emphasis on heavy industry. Revolutions never change everything, but they do, if at all successful, change a lot. The core components of 20th century revolutions add up to four or five basic points. Obviously, each revolution has its own imprint, its own biography, and it's significant to spend some time on individual profiles, who the leaders were, and leaders can have a tremendous role in shaping revolutionary dynamics, what the actual specific grievances were, and of course what the outcomes were. For purposes of world history, however, I think it's fair to go beyond the individual profiles and look at some general features, both in terms of causation and then, even more significant, consequence. Causes, first of all, include weak regimes. It's a truism, obvious perhaps, but revolutions do not occur against regimes that are full of vim and vigor, even if they're corrupt and unjust in other respects. Regimes that have the power and will to send the military against revolutionaries, particularly in the 20th century, where military armaments were so superior to the weapons available to civilians, these regimes are not toppled. Now, of course, they may be eroded by failed revolutionary efforts. A regime may be weakened over time, but one component of all the major 20th century revolutions involves weak and vulnerable regimes. A czar who is inept, influenced by a crazy advisor, is an invitation to revolution in this sense. A boy emperor in China, heir to the throne but not yet capable of really wielding power. An aging dictator in Mexico. An aging Shah in Iran, ill to boot. These are components of regimes that had previously been capable of effective repression, but were losing their will, losing their grip, and in which, characteristically, key segments of the military either refused to move against revolutionary dissidents or actually joined them. Component number one, consistent in broad outline across the cases. Component number two, every revolution, this is true in the earlier Atlantic episodes and certainly in the 20th century, every revolution needs at least one large social group that has elements that are perfectly willing to engage in violence, who feel violence is justified in order to achieve legitimate social ends. In the 20th century revolutions, the most consistent provider of this kind of revolutionary muscle came from the peasantry. 20th century revolutions were heavily peasant in composition and dynamic, and peasants characteristically wanted greater access to land in a period in which population growth was pinching resources, abolition of the landlord class and their continued claims over peasant labor and peasant revenues. They wanted what they saw as social justice in the countryside. They believed that the land was legitimately theirs, that it was being taken from them, and they needed and could act with justice to redress the balance. Many revolutions in the 20th century also, of course, involved a working class or proletarian component in the cities. Russia was sufficiently industrialized in 1917, and the workers sufficiently, if illegally, organized that worker risings in St. Petersburg and Moscow played a significant role in the revolutionary outbreak. Workers were also involved in the Mexican Revolution, but the working class component is a bit more of a variable. Peasant revolution is really a core feature of 20th century revolutions, at least in most of the major cases. A third component, along with weak regimes and a sense of real social entitlement, a third component involves what I think might be called an ideological buildup. Before the revolution, usually illegally, sometimes partly through activities in exile, a key factor both in the Soviet Union and in Iran, ideologies are disseminated that help inspire many revolutionaries, and particularly many revolutionary leaders. it's important to remember it's easy to sit here and stand here and pontificate about what revolutions involved. It's really important to remember that dedicated revolutionaries risk a tremendous amount. They're risking their freedom, they're risking their lives, and the inspiration of a guiding ideology is almost crucial. They may be misguided, they may be open to criticism in various respects, but one has to respect, in most instances, the sincerity, sometimes even the fanaticism, of the ideological principle. Various ideologies obviously served in the 20th century. In Mexico, and to a certain extent in early China, and even very early Russia, revolutionaries in some instances were inspired by liberal and democratic principles, the notion that regimes should provide political access to all peoples, that regimes should protect individual liberties, that they should be constitutional, etc. In the Iranian case, the dominant ideology, developed initially in exile, was a restatement of what people like the Ayatollah Khomeini viewed as the fundamentals of Islam. The ideology came particularly from the religion, although early in the Iranian Revolution, there were liberal and even a few communist components as well. They quickly got shoved to the side. But the dominant revolutionary ideology of the 20th century, operative in Russia, ultimately in China, in Vietnam, in Cuba, and elsewhere, the dominant revolutionary ideology was, of course, Marxism. Marxist analysis, developed in the 19th century, called for an understanding that capitalism was creating a growing majority of oppressed working-class people, taking their wages in order to swell capitalist coffers, that justice called for an overthrow of the system. Marxist ideology also urged that revolution had, in fact, history on its side. The ultimate course of revolution was predetermined by a larger historical dynamic in which ruling groups would create their own antithesis, and the antithesis would swell and grow and ultimately triumph. The sense of inevitability did not deter revolutionaries from feeling that they also needed to work terribly hard for the revolution, but it provided some ultimate comfort. And Marxism, and this I think is too frequently forgotten in American treatments of the subject, Marxism also provided a truly glowing view of the ultimate future of a revolutionary society. After a period of adjustment, after a period of proletarian dictatorship in which the trappings of the bourgeois regime would be culled out, a society would emerge in which people produced spontaneously what they could produce, took from society what they needed, the state would wither away, inequalities against women would be eradicated. This was human perfection, and the process of history, once this perfection was achieved, would then stop. A beautiful vision. We may dismiss it as unrealistic or even undesirable, but its beauty, I think, has to be acknowledged, at least in explaining why this ideology proved so inspirational in, again, so many otherwise different settings. Final component in the 20th century revolutions was some degree of concern, and this could relate to Marxism or Islamic fundamentalism, some degree of concern about undue Western ownership and influence. The Iranian revolutionaries very clearly were concerned about American and European influence in the oil industry, in other modernizing sectors in Iran under the Shah, and wanted Iranian cultural values to be reasserted. Mexican revolutionaries far earlier worried about the extent of American ownership of Mexican land and property. Russian revolutionaries, including ordinary workers, were inspired in part by concern about the large number of foreign owners in Russian industry and the kinds of profits that were being siphoned off. Concern about Western control, if you will. Concern about signs of Western core economic activities, as well as cultural influence, provided a final spark for the revolutionary tinder. What did the revolutions accomplish? Here, again, if time permitted, one would need a case-by-case analysis because consequences varied greatly with the dynamic and goals of the revolutions themselves. But in general, 20th century revolutions, first of all, uniformly produced authoritarian regimes. They might have intended otherwise, particularly in early liberal days. But revolutions produce authoritarian regimes inevitably, at least for a while, for several good reasons. Revolutions, major revolutions of the sort we're discussing here in the first place, produce internal backlash. Aristocrats, conservatives, sometimes religious leaders, begin to organize often military movements against the revolution, and this induces the revolutionaries to feel, well, we may have wanted a liberal regime, but we've got to regroup, we've got to impose authority, we've got to emphasize the leadership role. In many key revolutions, and again this was true in the Atlantic period as well as the contemporary period, in many key revolutions there's also significant foreign resistance. The Russian Revolution, for example, was greeted by half-hearted but not insignificant invasion attempts by the United States, Britain, France, and Japan. The Japanese stayed longest. Foreign invasion can help inspire revolutionary leaders, or simply foreign opposition, as in the case of Iran, can help inspire leaders to say, we need to pool our resources toward authoritarian control to defend the revolution against its enemies. It's noteworthy, however, that while these impulses toward authoritarianism crop up in every major revolution regardless of time, they occurred quicker and more fully in the 20th century cases than had been true in the Atlantic Revolutionary period. There were fewer liberals around to defend liberal principles. Authoritarian impulses under communists or Islamic fundamentalists triumphed much more rapidly. Second consequence. Social change would be at least undertaken to some degree, and in some cases it would prove overwhelming. It was revolution, communist revolution, in Russia and then in China, that eliminated the landlord class, sometimes with great brutality, sometimes with ham-handed efforts at re-education or political discipline, but the social change here was significant. The Mexican Revolution, as suggested earlier, went less far in this regard, but even here, there was significant social change in some regions and enough whetting of appetites to suggest that further social change might be in the offing. Revolutions in the 20th century uniformly attempted cultural reconditioning. Whatever their specific goals, 20th century revolutionaries agreed that the revolution should provide an opportunity to create a new kind of human being, to reorient cultural signals inherited from the past and often operating under foreign influence as well. Thus, one of the key strengths, in many ways one of the key triumphs of the Mexican Revolution, which was a little half-hearted in the social realm, one of the key triumphs was the emergence of a new kind of populist culture, embellished by significant artistic and architectural efforts to express the people, to pay homage to the Indian heritage of Mexico, to pay homage to the importance of workers and peasants. Obviously, the communist revolutions would spend a great deal of time emphasizing cultural re-education, emphasizing new artistic principles under the banners of socialist realism, and cultural reconditioning was one of the key points of the Iranian Revolution as well. These efforts might not fully pay off. Foreign influence, among other things, could never be as fully eliminated as some of the revolutionaries hoped. But the effort to retool culture and the effort certainly to expand education and to use education to create new types of people, this effort was a significant part of the revolutionary outcroppings as well. Finally, all the revolutions, though to different degrees depending on their power, did reduce Western influence, at least for a time. Owners were expropriated. Landlords were kicked out. The Mexican Revolution didn't manage to eliminate United States influence as fully as hoped, but there was some adjustment. The cultural efforts were obviously designed to provide a regional revolutionary alternative both to the traditional culture and to foreign culture. The recasting of Western influence, at least for several decades, is an important part of the revolutionary process as well. And in all the major revolutions, and this goes back to the basic definition, new types of people were propelled into opportunities at political